Hello, this is Victoria Pearson and this is Radio Gorgeous, and this week is Man Week, and so I have a gorgeous man, Guy Signer from Allo Allo. Guy, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you very much, Victoria, and it's very nice to be here.
Fantastic. Now, how did your acting career begin?
Well, family history says that I made the announcement at age 11 that this was what I was going to do with my life. I don't remember saying so, but I can't remember ever really wanting to do anything else. So I was always going to, you know, get out of school as quickly as possible, go to drama school and get on with being an actor.
You've obviously got this huge career in theatre. When did that start? Did it start as a teenager or?
No, I did the usual sort of school, you know, college plays and that sort of thing. And I suppose I stood out and everybody seemed to assume it was what I was going to do. I certainly did. And then I went to drama school. I was turned down a couple of years for being too young. But I was trying when I was far too young, lying about my age and so on. But eventually I went to the Webber Douglas, and when I graduated from the Webber D, I went straight into the theatre, that day.
And what was your first acting role? Can you remember?
Well, actually, my first acting role was a night's filming at the BBC on a series called Zed Cars.
Oh, yeah.
And that takes us back. I don't know whether your listener is old enough to remember that.
Yeah.
Yes, it was a very long time ago. But that, yeah, I had a night's filming, freezing my arse off on a disused lot in Acton. My best friend and I, who left drama school at the same time, this was my job, as I say, freezing cold in Acton.
Yeah.
Very unglamorous, and he went off to shoot a Kellogg's commercial in the Caribbean. I thought it was deeply unfair.
That is really unfair, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, you are most famous for the part of Lieutenant Gruber in Allo Allo. How did you go about making this character likeable?
It's interesting you ask that. I didn't.
Okay.
It's just who he was. I didn't ever think, I must be likeable. I just, you know, did it, said the lines and played the man, and he was likeable. I always say when interviewed that I miss him terribly. He was a much nicer man than I am, and I wish he was still in my life. Hubert was not a Nazi. He was not in any way political. He was simply, you know, like many soldiers on both sides. He was simply doing his job, and he was a tank commander. And that was his job, was to command a tank. And if you know about medals and so on, he was quite highly decorated as well. So his service on the Russian front had obviously been quite distinguished.
You and Gordon Kaye seemed to have a strong connection in the show. What was he like to work with?
I enjoyed working with Gordon enormously. The sort of set piece scenes that we had at the bar were always wonderfully funny and very difficult to record because the audience were laughing so much. But the writing was beautiful.
Yeah.
And that was really the secret of the whole thing. Gordon was a very capable comedic actor, and we understood each other very well from the start, I think, he and I. And so we managed to be quite funny together. I occasionally catch an episode, and I'm still really quite surprised not only how good it is, but how relevant it is. How it still works, which is extraordinary, because most comedy series after so many years don't. They feel tired. Occasionally, it's almost sacrilege to say so, but I find the occasional episode of Dad's Army really very creaky now, even though it's a wonderful series.
Mm.
And there are some marvellous episodes, and there are a couple of actors in there who were truly fine comedians. I mean, I think particularly of John LeMessurier. But yes, as I say, occasionally it feels a very, it feels a little creaky. Mm. Whereas Hello, Hello, it seems not to. Mm. And trust me, I hate watching my own work. If I do find myself watching it, it is not to watch myself, it's to watch my friends. I always have the same reaction to myself, which is, you know, you're too fat and too bald and you're a squeaky voice. And please, you know, David, can I do it all again? Because I know how to do it right now.
That's true of a lot of people.
Yeah. Always my reaction. I don't know. My work, but yes, to Hello, Hello particularly.
Definitely. What is the magic formula that makes Perry and Croft's comedies so timeless and replayable?
Well, this was Jeremy Lloyd and David Croft, of course.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah.
Perry. But if I knew that, I'd be rich. I think you used the word magic, and that is the right word. It's just unexplainable. They were both, in their way, geniuses. Jeremy, with characterization and dialogue, he was quite extraordinary. I saw evidence of this where his brain was so quick, comedic brain, if you like. I mean, he was a great friend of mine, and we spent a lot of time together, so I saw evidence of it every day. But in the studio, in the rehearsal room, you know, occasionally we would have a problem with a line. An actor would say, you know, I'm not sure about this, or David would say, this joke's not working quite as well as I'd like, and, you know, what do you think? And Jeremy would be in the corner reading a paper, and we'd call him over, and he'd say, what's the problem? David'd say, well, you know, this joke, what do you think? Yeah, you know, and Jeremy would put his finger to his mouth and think for a minute, literally for a minute. And he would come up with a new joke, a new line. And it was always either just as funny or funnier than the original. He just was a master.
And the talent of these writers is the things that they throw away are just as good as the things they keep in.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And also, I think it's very significant that we would, you know, what I just described to you was very rare. We would come to the rehearsal room on a Monday morning and have a read through, and the chances are that what we read through on the Monday is exactly word for word, I mean letter for letter, what would be recorded at the end of the week. Yeah. It was very rare that anything needed to be changed. And very rare.
It's the timing of the joke. You've got to have that rhythm.
Yes, the rhythm, and they wrote in beautiful rhythm. I mean, I always quote as an example of that, when people talk about, you know, writing comedy, I mean, we have obviously, you know, in English, we have people like Noel Coward and Oscar Wilde, but in America, Neil Simon, Doc Simon, okay, who's, again, you know, I've done many plays of his, and his dialogue is perfection, and it is so good, and the rhythm is so perfect that if you get a word out of place, it's wrong. It's just wrong. Suddenly it upsets the rhythm, and you know, you find a little trip, and you think, "What? Why is there a little trip in this sentence?" And you go back to the script, and you think, "Oh yeah, it's because I'm not reading it right. Yeah. I'm not reading exactly what he wrote."
Yeah. And I find also with comedy, if people go back over it and try to improve it, they ruin it.
Especially, you know, something like, you know, David Croft and Jeremy Lloyd, it is so perfect, you need to leave it alone.
Absolutely.
You know, don't try and do anything with it. Yeah. You know, don't even try and act it. Just say the lines, you know, and pick up your paycheck. They've done all the work in the writing.
How do you adapt your theatrical techniques to the small screen? And how do you add depth to comedy characters?
Two entirely different questions, but the first... It's mainly a matter of scale. I remember my second job in television. No, it wasn't. It was my first. It was the job I was describing to you. And I had to, again, you know, the middle of the night and freezing cold. And when they finally called me to actually do one of my little scenes, I had to walk across a little bit of park and then cross a street and say something as I was halfway across the road. And a police car was stopped to let me cross the road. That was the point of the scene, was that later the policeman would remember having seen me. I was later murdered. And when I first did this scene, I thought, I know this, you know, I know where I'm walking, and the director's told me where to walk, and I know my line, and, you know, I'm an enthusiastic young actor, and I'm starting a career, and I'm going to be wonderful. And the director said, action. And about 5 seconds later, the cameraman screamed, cut, 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 cut. And the sound man ripped his cans off, his earphones off. And both of them said, you're not in the theatre now, guy. This is television. Yeah. Don't walk so fast. We didn't catch you at all. The camera didn't see you. It was just a blur. And don't shout. Just say the line. You've got a microphone on. You know, and I very quickly learned the lesson that, yes, that I was not on the stage. Unlike actors nowadays who I find inaudible in television, you know, we all learned to speak in the theatre. And, you know, my job was to be able to hit the back wall in the Royal Opera House, you know, if required, as I once was. You know, and for every single seat at the back of the gods to hear every word I said. And of course, you apply that to television or film, and you know, you're in big trouble. Mm. Suddenly, when you're, especially in film, you know, when you're up on a screen and you're, you know, 30 times life size, and they can see every hair in your nose, and you know, every word you say is as if you were whispering in their ear, you have to be very subtle. With your, both with your voice and with your body and your face. It's a much subtler art. And what was the other question that was disguised in the middle?
How do you add the depth to the comedy character?
Oh, again, that's a little bit like saying, you know, how did I make him likable? It's coming very close to the sort of constant question, which is basically, you know, how do you do what you do? What makes you funny? And always when asked, and I've been asked many times to teach comedy, especially when I was living in LA, people would beg me to teach comedy classes, and I always refused, simply because I think it's, you know, timing is a gift. I think it's the one aspect of our business which is it's the kiss of the god, and you either have it or you don't, and you can't teach it. But this, the essence of comedy, assuming you have some talent, the essence of comedy is truth. As soon as you lie to an audience, they find you out and they stop laughing. You have a fighting chance to be funny. That's what I observe from having been doing it for 50 years.
Yeah, totally. And you can all immediately see if somebody's got it or they haven't. Because I've done stand-up comedy myself, and I wasn't bad at it, but I saw quite a lot of people who really were bad at it, and I thought, you're never going to do this. You know, it just wasn't there.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? It is interesting how quickly one can see if one knows what one's looking for.
Yeah.
There's a lovely story about Noel Coward going to Hollywood at the height of his fame, you know, the great young playwright who had, you know, two plays on Broadway with the Lunts, and he, you know, two plays in the West End, and he was just, you know, the master. And everybody thought, this is the greatest, you know, actor, writer of the generation. And he went off to Hollywood, and some agent gave a glamorous party for him, and he, you know, everybody was there. Everybody in Hollywood wanted to be seen with Noel Coward because he was the, you know, the hot young thing. And he said he was standing chatting to some luminary, some famous actress or something. And he turned around and Clark Gable walked in to the party. And he looked at him and he thought, now that is a movie star. What on earth am I doing here? And he booked his ticket home the next day. And it's absolutely the point, you know. And with comedy, it's slightly different. I mean, with a movie star, it's quite slightly different from comedy, but it's the same thing. You just know. And when you look at somebody like, you know, I suppose when you looked at somebody like Clark Abel, you just thought, yeah, oh yes, that, now that's a movie star.
Yeah.
I had exactly the same feeling when I met Johnny Depp.
Did you?
I thought, you know, what am I doing in this business? You know, that's a star.
What happens when you met? What happens when you met Johnny Depp?
Mind you, I'm funnier than he is. but you know, I do what I do. He does what he does. But he does what he does awfully well.
Because you were in the Pirates of the Caribbean, weren't you?
Yes, that's right.
And what happened?
What do you mean? What happened?
What happened when you met Johnny Depp? Anything funny exchange or?
Not really. No. I remember to this day, and I've said it in interviews before, I think it's on my website, that, you know, I met him. He was, I walked onto this pier sticking out over the water, a landing stage thing. And I walked out onto this thing where we were going to be filming, and the crew weren't there yet, but Johnny was, curiously, because I suppose he, both of us had been sent for and told, you know, your scene's up. And he was already there, and he was sitting on the end of this pier with his legs dangling over the water. And I waited. I thought, you know, he's probably going over his lines. And then I thought, well, you know, we're doing this scene together. Perhaps we'll, you know, we'll have a quick rehearsal. And anyway, I should introduce myself. So I rather diffidently went over. And long story short, he, you know, said, sit down. And I sat down beside him. And we both sat with our feet dangling in the water. And we had quite a nice conversation. And at the end of which I thought, this man is, he's gentle and kind and warm and friendly and very nice. And he's an exciting and dangerous actor, brilliant actor. He's made wonderful career choices, hasn't played the Hollywood game. He really is almost perfect. And he's married to one of the most beautiful women on the planet. And I actually thoroughly hate him. And I hated him from that moment to this.
Not really.
No, he was absolutely lovely. Lovely.
Lo and Lo is popular the world over. Have you had any bizarre fan mail from around the world?
Well, I don't know about bizarre. You know, everybody thinks, oh, you know, you probably got, you know, weird sort of things asking for your underpants or, you know, whether you wear leather. And it was none of that, really. I got the occasional fan mail. Again, remember, we're going back, you know, 20, 30 years, and things were sort of still rather different then. You know, when you were playing a gay character, you were skating, you know, on fairly thin ice. Mm. But all the letters I got were basically from gay people, basically were to say thank you for not sending them up, because they were used, and I don't mean this in a pejorative sense at all, because again, it was 10 years before, but they were used to John Inman. You know, they were used to somebody playing a gay character as a gay character, you know, swinging handbags and limp wrists and a fairy voice.
Yeah.
And suddenly along came me. When I was playing, I said to David, the very first day of rehearsal, I said, this man is a soldier. He's a tank commander. I can't, you know, I can't be doing the fey voice and the limp wrists. And he said, good decision.
Yeah.
He said, you do exactly what, you know, you just play him exactly the way you feel. I said, you know, because if he, you know, he would, first of all, his men wouldn't have any respect for him if he was, you know, if he had, I don't know, limp wrists and carried a handbag. You know, he was taking men to war, and you know, they had to have respect for him, so he had to be a man, even though he was a homosexual man, you know. So anyway, I didn't want to go too deeply into that, but yeah, so people would say, which is always rather touching, you know, thank you so much for not sending us up and making us look like idiots, sort of thing. Because, it's, again, as I say, this isn't a criticism of John Inman or indeed of anyone else, but it's, it, the world was changing at that time. And I think gay people were just starting, you know, it was the beginning of the Pride movements and all that. And they were just starting to think, hold on a minute, you know, We need to be treated as we are, you know, and very occasionally his wrist would fall limp. But, you know, that was quite deliberate.
I know exactly what you're talking about, the "Ooh, you are awful, Dick Emery," which is all really good and funny, but what you were doing was completely different. So he's a real person.
Yes. And that was sort of appreciated. And that was the only, for want of a better word, gay fan mail that I ever had. I do find it strange. I mean, I've had sort of proposals of marriage from China, where, you know, which is sort of bizarre. You know, from young girls who I suppose still assume I'm, you know, 35 or whatever I was when we were making Alola.
Okay.
And you know, so it's not that absurd. You know, they obviously haven't sort of registered how long ago it was. But that I find bizarre, and I think I wonder what it sounds like in Cantonese, or, you know, what I sound like in Cantonese.
That's quite sweet, really, isn't it?
It is.
You were in I, Claudius with Derek Jacobi. What was that experience like?
Extraordinary. It was, again, it was a different era. This was Studio One at the BBC, and we had a master crew. These people don't exist anymore. They were all fired by Bert. But, you know, then it was, they couldn't make one episode now, let alone a 13-episode series. It was just enormous. It was enormous. It was almost like being in a, you know, on a Hollywood film set. There were, you know, 30 or 40 actors and 50 extras and 100 crew. It was extraordinary. And it was wonderful being involved in something with so many, stars, frankly. I remember the read-through, you know, the first day when I think we read through about four or five episodes. And so quite a few actors came in, you know, who were in later episodes. And I happened to be in the first couple of eps, so I was there. And, of course, you know, people would come in, quite big stars would come in playing roles where they were, you know, they would say half a dozen lines and be killed. You know, off they'd go. So there were hundreds of actors involved, many of them very, very famous. And so for, you know, someone quite recently out of drama school, it was very exciting.
I can imagine. And it was very controversial at the time as well, wasn't it?
Was it?
Well, I think so. Because I remember my mum and her friends talking about it as if it was this outrageous thing that they'd never seen. But
I don't remember that aspect of it. It's funny you should say that.
Didn't get that reaction.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, what, sort of early ideas of Roman orgy, that kind of thing? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. And so John, the scenes with John Hurt and everything.
Right. But I don't think there was anything sort of overtly sexual or anything like that. No. I mean, good God, look at Game of Thrones.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. Well, that would be the pre-runner to Game of Thrones, maybe.
Yes, yes, yeah. I suppose it would. But, yeah. You know, we had to keep our clothes on in those days.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
And look, find our language.
Look how far
look at Game of Thrones.
I mean, look how far it's come now. I mean, you know, Game of Thrones is extraordinary.
But it was wonderful, and it was very exciting. I was friends with Derek Jacobi, and it was wonderful watching him, you know, develop this character and going through the 13 episodes. It was.
And finally, you've had many different roles in theatre and film over the years. What's your favourite one?
It has to be Hello, Hello.
Yeah.
You've mentioned several of them, but it must be Hello, Hello because I played it for 10 years, you know, more, when you count the, you know, the stage show and various tours. You know, it took me all over the world. It took me to Australia. It took me, to, you know, it was an extraordinary thing to have been involved in, and I got to work with some wonderful people and I got to play this lovely character who still, you know, people still, after, you know, 20, 30 years, people still find him endearing and still, you know, I still get fan mail every day of my life, really, and people still stop me in the street to say thank you, and that's a real gift.
That's a real gift. Oh, lovely. Guy Silas, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been fantastic.
Thank you. It's been very good fun. Thank you very much.
And for more gorgeous interviews, visit radiogorgeous.com.